It's the nuclear secret that never was, that Israel has the only nuclear arsenal in the Middle East. Its leaders have never confirmed it, nor never denied it. But one thing they cop to without hesitation is their total rejection of Iran ever getting the bomb. They talk about going to war to stop that from happening because they say that Israel cannot live with a nuclear Iran. Or can it? That's what we're here to debate, so let's do it. Yes or no to this statement, Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. A debate from Intelligence Squared US. I'm John Donvan. We have four superbly qualified debaters to argue for and against this motion, Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. Our debate, as always, will go in three rounds, and then you, the live audience, votes to choose a winner, and only one side wins. Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. On the side arguing for the motion, James Dobbins. He is the Director of International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. His partner is Reuven Pedetzur, a senior military affairs analyst with Haaretz. On the side arguing against the motion, Israel can live with a nuclear Iran, Shmuel Bar. He is Director of Studies at the Institute of Policy and Strategy in Herzliya, Israel, and his partner, Jeffrey Goldberg, who is National Correspondent for The Atlantic and columnist for Bloomberg View. Our motion is, our motion is Israel can live with a nuclear Iran, and now let's meet the team arguing for the motion. First, let's welcome, again, James Dobbins. And Jim, you are now at RAND, where you are Director of International Security and Defense Policy Center, but in a previous life, working with the State Department, you were at the talks for the conference for the setting up of the state of Afghanistan after the wake of 9/11, and in that, you were involved in negotiations that involved the Iranians, and you said that actually the Iranian delegation was helpful in the process, and you know that that's not really the reputation that the Iranians normally bring to the table.
Well, they were helpful. I think it was a sort of a combination of gratitude and fear. They were grateful that we just knocked off one of their two principal regional rivals, which was the Taliban, and they were fearful that they might be next. And so it was a combination. It was also a different Iranian government than the one we have today. It was a reformist regime operating within an environment that limited their powers, but not limited it to the point they couldn't reach out. It was a genuine opportunity that we flubbed. I'm not going to argue tonight that we still have that opportunity.
James Dobbins. And your partner is? Your partner is Reuven Pedetzur.
Oh, excuse me. I thought I was finished. Yes. Reuven Pedetzur.
Okay. Reuven Pedetzur, ladies and gentlemen. Reuven, you are also arguing for the motion that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. You have obviously a serious personal stake in this. You are a resident of the State of Israel. You were a fighter pilot. You were a pilot in the Israeli Air Force. You now write for the Haaretz newspaper on issues of security and military affairs. Reuven, you told us back in 2006, 7 years ago, where you stood on this issue when you wrote a piece back then that said, let them have nukes, them being Iran. What sort of reaction did you get back then?
There was no reaction whatsoever, because you should know that in Israel there are no public debates on nuclear issues. It's a taboo. Uh-huh. So there was no reaction.
And if that happened today?
The same.
Yeah, well, we're going to have a debate tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, Reuven Pedetzur. Our motion is Israel can live with a nuclear Iran, and two debaters arguing against it. First, Shmuel Bar, ladies and gentlemen. Shmuel, like your opponent, you have that stake of being an Israeli citizen. You also served in war as an intelligence officer. You now direct studies at the Institute of Policy and Strategy in Herzliya, Israel. Just a short preview of your argument here. It's sometimes argued that the Iranians would be no more interested in a nuclear war than the Soviets were during the Cold War, and they didn't use it. So give us one reason that that argument just doesn't end this debate right now.
Well, since I'm a historian, I've noticed that if during history everybody had acted according to the rational actor model, then most of what we know as history wouldn't have happened. Pearl Harbor wouldn't have happened. Barbarossa wouldn't have happened. Certainly Stalingrad wouldn't have happened. So apparently things happen which are not necessarily because it's in the interest of somebody to let it happen, but because of other dynamics.
Shmuel Bar, ladies and gentlemen. And your partner is?
Jeff Goldberg. I know how to pronounce it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jeffrey Goldberg. Jeffrey, you're also arguing against the motion that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. You're a national correspondent for The Atlantic, a columnist for Bloomberg View. You're in a unique position here in that you've had more exclusive interviews with Bibi Netanyahu, I think, than any other American journalist over the past several years. You've been inside the guy's head, or even near the head. You've not
inside.
Inside. Where do you think he is in terms of his thinking seriously about his willingness to go to war over this? Is it a posture or is it a decision?
Well, I would say first that, you know, there are teams of neuroscientists in a bunker under the White House trying to figure out what's in Netanyahu's head. So it's a mystery to me, too. I would say, to sum him up in a sentence, I would say that he has many manifestations of a typical insincere politician on the Iran question. I think he's actually sincere. What that means for policy, I don't know, but he is very sincerely gripped by this issue.
And he's not liking you very much these days.
We're having difficulties in our relationship, yes, at the moment.
Thank you, Jeffrey Goldberg. Ladies and gentlemen, our four debaters. Check with the guys in the basement of the White House. So as we said before, in this debate, you, our live audience, act as our judges. By the time the debate is over, we will have asked you two times to vote. The first time telling us where you stand on this motion before hearing the debate, the motion being Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. Then we'll have you vote a second time after the debate is over, where you stand on the on that point after hearing the arguments. And the team who has moved its numbers the most over the course of the evening will be declared our winner. So let's register your preliminary vote. Our motion is Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. If you side with this motion at this point, push number one on your keypad. If you're against it, push number two. And if you're undecided, push number three. And if you think that you made a mistake, just correct it. The system will lock in the last vote that you did, and all of the other numbers are inactive. So just deal with one, two, or three. And it looks like everybody is done. So remember again, we're going to reveal the result of that vote after you've heard all the arguments and after you have voted the second time. That will come at the end of the debate in its final minutes, and that is how you, our audience, will choose the winner. So we go in three rounds, and first on to round one, opening statements from each debater in turn. They will be 7 minutes each. And here to speak first for the motion, Reuven Pedatzur, arguing that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. He is a senior military affairs analyst with the Haaretz newspaper and a senior lecturer in political science at Tel Aviv University. He's a former pilot for the Israeli Air Force and serves as director of the S. Daniel Abraham Center for Strategic Dialogue at Netanya Academic Center. Ladies and gentlemen, Reuven Pedatzur.
Good evening. Where are the results? No results yet? Anyway, can Israel live in a nuclear Iran? The short answer is yes. Any questions? Okay, but the real question is not this one. The real question, do we have another choice? And unfortunately, the answer is no. Because it's possible, despite of all pressures and sanctions, and even if there will be an Israeli military attack, that in this decade, Iran will have nuclear weapons. So the question is for the Israeli policymakers, what then? What will be our policy in this case when Iran will have the weapons? Unfortunately, there is no public debates on this, so we don't know what they think over there about the future policy. What should Israel do when there will be an hostile Iran with nuclear weapons? The most effective and maybe the only way to deter Iran is to abandon our ambiguity, nuclear ambiguity, and to move toward unconcealed nuclear deterrence. And since in Israel we have censorship, as you know, I have to play the game. And when I refer to Israeli nuclear deterrence, Israeli nuclear weapons, Israeli nuclear submarines with nuclear missiles, it's all according to foreign sources. I don't know anything, and I have to use this phrase, according to foreign sources. But Israel has to change its policy and to move, as I said, to a nuclear deterrence and to with new rules of the game. And the other side which should know what are the rules of the game. There will be red lines that the Iranian will understand it. For example, if Israel will detect a ballistic missile launched in Iran going westerly, for Israel it will be the nuclear missiles. And in this case, Israel will not wait to see whether it is a nuclear missile or not. Automatically, Israel will launch its nuclear missiles, according to foreign sources, and it, Tehran, Tabriz, Qom, Isfahan, and so on and so on. And it should be clear to the other side what will happen. And then the Ayatollahs in Tehran will have to decide whether to launch their missiles when they know exactly what will happen. What will happen that Iran will be destroyed and will go back to the Middle Ages. And I don't see any Iranian national interest that justify this cost. So I believe that we can deter them. I believe that the other team will use the argument of irrationality. We cannot deter this extremist Muslim Ayatollahs. And if this is the case, we cannot deter them, then Netanyahu is right and we have to attack. But I don't think this is the case. Because if we'll have a very clear policy of nuclear deterrence, then the chances that the other side will use the weapons are very slim or not existent. For this, we'll have to change not just the policy, we have to show and declare our second strike capability in order to show the Iranians what we have. And again, according to foreign sources, we have submarines, Dolphin class, with nuclear missiles. So we have second strike capability, probably. So when they use the argument of irrationality, everybody goes to the Cold War and say the Ayatollahs are not like the leaders of the two superpowers. They are not rational. They are not going to act like the Soviet leaders or the American leaders, which is wrong, I believe, because if you can remember during the Cold War how Stalin was perceived here in the States, a madman that whenever he'll have the bomb, he's going to drop the bomb. And the Ayatollahs are not like this. And if it seems from professional and sober analysis that the Iranian will, if we'll learn their way of thinking, their culture, their history, they are going to act like real rational leaders. We should understand that the development of the Iranian nuclear weapons is not against Israel. It's based on their experience during the war, the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s, not against Israel. And it's very important to understand it, what is the base of their thinking about their nuclear program. And ironically, possession of nuclear weapons may moderate the Iranian leadership, exactly what happened with the Chinese leadership in 64 when they got the nuclear weapons, and they started acting like a rational state. And another example is India and Pakistan. Only 23 seconds more?
Well, now 19.
Really?
Well, now it's 15.
So India and Pakistan, there were three wars after they acquired the nuclear weapons in 98. About after a year, there was a Kargil crisis, and they act very rationally in order not to deteriorate the situation and using the nuclear war.
Reuven Pedatzur, your time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our motion is that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran, and here to speak against this motion, Jeffrey Goldberg. He is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and a columnist for Bloomberg View. Before joining The Atlantic, Goldberg was a Middle East correspondent and the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeffrey Goldberg.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you to Intelligence Squared. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Reuven. I, as someone who's covered Pakistan extensively, I'm not going to sit here and make believe that I would hold up Pakistan as a model of stability and rational nuclear deterrence, but we can talk about that later. But since you brought up the subject of the nature of the Iranian regime and what they believe and what they think and what they seek, let's talk about that for a minute. What we have right now in the world is a genuinely unprecedented situation, certainly unprecedented in the post-World War II international order. We have a member state of the United Nations, the Islamic Republic of Iran, that actively calls for the destruction of another member state of the United Nations. That is Israel. And they're very, very clear and consistent on this subject, right from the beginning of the Islamic Republic. I'll give you a couple of examples. This is from the supreme leader of Iran, who, as his title suggests, is the supreme leader. He's the guy who sets the policy. Quote, this is from last February, "The Zionist regime is a true cancer tumor on this region that should be cut off, and it definitely will be cut off." His feelings are echoed regularly among the Iranian military and intelligence elite. I'll give you another example. General Gholam Reza Jalali, the former commander of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, said last August that, quote, "The fact is that there is no other way but to stand firm and resist until Israel is destroyed." General Hassan Ferozbadi, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, said last May, and I quote, "The Iranian nation is standing for its cause, which is the full annihilation of Israel." Finally, Mohammad Hassan Rahimian, who is a top aide to Khamenei, said in a January 2010 television interview, quote, "We have manufactured missiles that allow us, when necessary, to replace Israel in its entirety with a big Holocaust." Mr. Rahimian is the deputy minister for subtlety in the Iranian regime. Iranian opposition to Israel's existence is not only ideological and rhetorical. We have to remember that in addition to actually calling for the destruction of the Jewish state, the Iranian regime works to destroy individual Jews. Hezbollah, the Lebanese terror group, is a proxy of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. The rockets that it fires periodically into Israel are Iranian manufacture. The rockets that Hamas fires from Gaza very recently are Iranian rockets. Let's not forget, in the last year, you have multiple examples around the world of Iranians trying to kill Israelis in Bulgaria, in Azerbaijan, in Georgia, in Thailand. And let's not forget a fact I find very amazing, which is that the current defense minister of Iran is actually sought by international law enforcement authorities for direct complicity in the bombing of a Jewish community center in Argentina. So you're dealing with a regime that regularly calls for the annihilation of the Jewish state. You're dealing with a regime that seeks to destroy and kill individual Jews, and which begs the question, what would be the impact on Middle East stability and on the safety of Israel if this regime, which seeks the annihilation, states very plainly it seeks the annihilation of the Jewish state, were to gain a weapon that would help it actually bring about that annihilation? And that's the question that we're dealing with today. Now, there are three ways to sort of deal with this dilemma, I think. The first is to sort of say, yeah, you know, On the one hand, it's true that the Iranian regime is the foremost sponsor of terrorism in the world, and it denies the Holocaust while calling for a new Holocaust, and it executes people for being gay, and it threatens Christian pastors with execution unless they convert to Islam, and it's responsible for a quarter of the American combat deaths in Iraq, and it hides many leaders of Al-Qaeda within its borders. But on the other hand, no one's perfect. And I'm sure that these, you know, gay-hanging, Christian-persecuting, American-killing, Jew-hating mullahs, if they get hold of a bomb, will behave in a responsible, rational, and enlightened way. The second response is what I call the, for lack of a better term, the Uncle Morty response, because a lot of us have an Uncle Morty sitting in Boca who spends all day on the internet trying to prove that Barack Obama is Osama bin Laden's third cousin by marriage. And the Uncle Morty response, is to say, you know, it's 1938 and the second Holocaust is beginning next Tuesday and we're all done and we're finished. The third response, and this is what I want to get into during the course of this debate, the third response is to acknowledge a couple of things. One is that it isn't 1938. The Jewish people do not stand defenseless and naked before the world. Iran, the day after it gets a bomb, will probably not fire that single bomb at Israel. But it's also clear that Israel in a post-nuclear Iran Middle East is going to have a very, very hard time surviving. Three quick reasons why it's going to have a hard time surviving. My colleague Shmuel in a few minutes is going to talk about why the Cold War models of mutual deterrence don't really apply in this situation. I'm going to talk about reasons that it's going to be difficult for Israel to survive even if there is no nuclear confrontation. The first is very clear to everyone, including President Obama. The day after Iran goes nuclear, there's going to be a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. President Obama has warned about this. He said very explicitly that a nuclear arms race in the world's most volatile region is inherently destabilizing. So you're dealing with, in a few years' time, the possibility that four or five different countries that all hate each other are going to be pointing nuclear-tipped missiles at each other. That's not a recipe for stability or happiness. It's certainly not a recipe for stability for the Jewish state. Second reason. If you believe that Israel can only survive if it makes peace with its neighbors, then you will be opposed to the idea of Iran getting a nuclear bomb. Israel cannot survive in a Middle East in which America is a defeated and weakened ally. America is Israel's most important ally. If Iran trumps America, if Iran beats America by getting a nuclear weapon, it means that the Arab states that would predisposed to make peace with Israel, and we know the peace process is semi-moribund anyway, they will align with Iran because Iran is the winner of that conflict. The third and most obvious point is Hamas and Hezbollah even now periodically fire large numbers of rockets at Israeli civilians. Imagine the power that they will have when they can fire those rockets under the protection of the Iranian nuclear umbrella. Again, there is a real chance that an Iranian nuclear weapon would lead to a conflagration in the Middle East. Even without that conflagration, it becomes very, very hard to envision how Israel survives in the long term. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeffrey Goldberg. And a reminder of what's going on, we are halfway through the opening round of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan. We have four debaters, two against two, who are arguing it out over this motion, Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. You've heard two of the opening statements, and now on to the third, debating in support of the argument, James Dobbins. He is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State and Special Envoy under the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. He is now Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Ladies and gentlemen, James Dobbins.
Well, just to remind us what we're debating about, the proposition is, can Israel live with a nuclear Iran? Can Israel survive a nuclear Iran? The answer to that question is yes. You don't need to be absolutely certain it will survive. In fact, technically, you don't even think it has to be probable that it will survive, just that it's possible that it will survive. And I think both of the opposition will acknowledge that it's possible it will survive. Indeed, Jeff said that they'd have a hard time, which implicitly indicates that there's a good possibility they'd survive. It'd just be harder. But so, I mean, I think if you debate at that level, it's pretty clear. There's almost nobody who thinks that Israel's demise will be automatic and certain. It's a question of risk. And so I think, in a sense, the real debate is, should Israel live with a nuclear Iran? And the answer is, not if they can help it, obviously. Nobody thinks a nuclear Iran is a good idea, and we're already doing a lot to try to prevent it. We have a massive, probably unprecedented international sanctions regime, an active, if so far unproductive, diplomatic process, a very active and somewhat successful covert sabotage effort, and cyber attacks. Now, these may work in some combination, but I'd have to acknowledge that they may not. And so the remaining question is, should one, in the, if these fail, go to war to prevent Israel, Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon? And I think, although that's not precisely what we're debating, it does tend to be, the issue does tend to revolve around that. Now, the threshold for saying yes, that we should go to war to prevent Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon, really has to go, there are two thresholds. One is efficacy, and one is unintended consequences. You need to look at both. In terms of efficacy, I think most experts believe that an Israeli attack on Iran would set the program back by perhaps 2 years, that an American attack would be more effective and would set it back by maybe 4 or 5 years. It wouldn't prevent it, but it would slow it down. What about the unintended consequences? Well, most people are concerned about the possibility of counterattacks. Iran begins rocketing Israeli nuclear facilities, terrorist attacks. But in many ways, the more dangerous response is, first of all, that an unprovoked attack on Iran validates their case for a nuclear weapon, for a nuclear deterrence. North Korea doesn't suffer those kinds of attacks. Pakistan doesn't suffer those kinds of attacks. Many in the world and in Iran will come around to the view that maybe Iran actually needs a nuclear weapon. A second consequence is that you begin to collapse the international coalition that so far has made Iran a pariah state, that has cut off its access to international markets, international, not just nuclear technology, but any kind of military technology, and increasingly even cut back dramatically its oil sales. And as a result, Iran gains access to the world economy. It breaks out of its isolation, and even perhaps certainly gains access to sophisticated military technology. In the aftermath of an attack, wouldn't Russia be prepared to sell Iran the kind of air defense systems which so far it's refused to sell Iran, and perhaps even nuclear technology from states like Pakistan or others, North Korea? I think in evaluating these consequences, one has to go back to the question of what is it that we, and for that matter most Israelis, fear about Iran? And I think Jeff has pretty much answered that question. It's not Iranian invasion. It's Iranian subversion. It's Iran's capacity to appeal to militant elements within neighboring populations, dissident elements within neighboring populations, in order to galvanize their efforts both against their own regimes in many cases and against Israel. It's Iranian influence, it's Iranian capacity for subversion. It's not that Iran is going to march across two intervening states and invade Israel that is of concern, and the fear is that they would be emboldened and they do more of this. But I think you have to ask yourself, which kind of Iran would have more influence with these dissident populations, not with governments, but with dissident populations in places like Gaza and Lebanon and other Middle East states, an Iran that had nuclear weapons or an Iran that was the victim of an unprovoked attack? Which of those two would give Iran greater influence and capacity to mobilize those kinds of populations? I think the answer to that is fairly clear. Now, the argument that Iran would be emboldened by possessing a nuclear weapon is certainly, I think, a real danger, but it's far from a certainty. It's not the historic pattern. You know, our major problems with the Soviet Union and particularly with China occurred before they had nuclear weapons. You know, the Soviet Union gobbled up all of Eastern Europe before it had nuclear weapons. We had nuclear weapons. They didn't. China actually attacked the United States and Korea and waged a two-year war with the United States and Korea. They didn't have nuclear weapons. We did. Once they got nuclear weapons, we didn't have any more wars. Now, we had lots of confrontations, but they were eventually diffused. Both North Korea and Pakistan do behave irresponsibly on occasion, but there is a certain stability in their relations with India, Pakistan's relations with India, North Korea's relations with South Korea. There haven't been conflicts in either case. So the argument that they'd be emboldened to the point of actually threatening to use nuclear weapons or using nuclear weapons or even engaging in the kind of behavior that they're not engaging in now, and I think if you listen to Jeff's list of all the things they're doing, you'd have to ask, well, what the hell else could they do that they're not already doing? And I think the answer is not much.
Thank you, James Dobbins. Our motion is that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. And now our final debater, who will be speaking against the motion, Shmuel Bar. He is the Director of Studies at the Institute of Policy and Strategy in Herzliya. He is also a Senior Research Fellow for the International Institute for Nonproliferation Studies. Shmuel, you can start making your way to the lectern. He served for 30 years in the Israeli government, in the Israeli Defense Forces Intelligence, and in the office of the Prime Minister. Ladies and gentlemen, Shmuel Bar.
Thank you. First of all, I won't go into the post-attack scenarios that were brought up, but suffice to say that I could offer more optimistic scenarios. When you shuffle a deck of cards, then you play a completely new game. I recall that when we took out the Iraqi reactor, we thought it would delay it for 3 years, but it took about 10 years, and the Iraqis did not get back to the level that they were before we took out the Ozirak. Now, the arguments that have brought up the rational actor model, which I've already made some remark as a historian about, and the idea that deterrence works, and the other, the Cold War paradigm can be applied. I would argue that we have to look at both of these assumptions in a completely different manner. First of all, the rational actor model. Somebody, not me, McNamara, said that Castro was a rational man, Khrushchev was a rational man, Kennedy was a rational man, and three rational men almost brought their nations into utter destruction. And that was without any, I mean, Che Guevara said that it would be that if Cuba had to be destroyed in order to destroy the destroy capitalism, then Cuba would be thankful for that. But in other words, rational people sometimes do things, or the dynamics between rational people, rational leaders, sometimes leads to things which are not rational. The other thing is that strategic surprises have happened. I don't think there's anybody here who would debate the fact that strategic surprises have happened. And when they happen because things that hordes of analysts and pundits and journalists have said are completely impossible because it is irrational that people will act that way, but they happened. So the fact is that these surprises happen, and they reflect dynamics which were not pure game theory rational behavior. Now, the other thing is that if nuclear weapons make countries more responsible, then I would propose that the United States, which wants to reduce its nuclear arsenal, should now just divvy out all of the American nuclear weapons to the whole world, and then everybody will become very responsible, very rational, and peace on earth and goodwill towards men. Now to the Cold War paradigm. The Cold War paradigm, let's define what it was. It was bilateral. It was a paradigm which from a certain stage had mutually assured destruction, with each party having a second strike capability. It was with levels of intelligence that when these both of the United States and Soviet Union acquired that capability, the second strike capability, they also had satellites in the sky, so they had a reasonable picture of what was going on in the silos of the respective enemies. There were mutual communications after Cuba, And there was also a perception of a taboo after Hiroshima. Now, when we're talking about a nuclear Iran, we have to understand we are talking about a polynuclear Middle East. The Shiite nuclear Shiite Iran is going to be perceived by the Sunni countries as something that cannot be countenanced, that they are going to have to acquire their own nuclear weapons. In a polynuclear Middle East where every country has a very small arsenal, they do not have mutually assured destruction. They have a sort of arsenal which is use it or lose it. If we are attacked, then we won't have a second chance. We are going to have multiple nuclear states with these small arsenals with very low levels of intelligence. They won't have satellite intelligence or very clear picture of what the real intentions of their enemy are. The size of the arsenals, it's better to have a lot of bombs than a few bombs, because then, of course, you have the propensity to say, well, if I don't use it now, I won't have a second chance. But then I want to go into something which has to do with command and control. And this is a very esoteric area, but in order to prevent unintentional use of nuclear weapons or use of nuclear weapons without total control over the process of what's called escalation dominance, you have to have very sophisticated capabilities. When you look at the command and control structures in the various countries of the Middle East and the paradigms which existed in the Cold War countries, you actually discover that most of the key elements which were instrumental in preventing nuclear confrontation during the Cold War do not exist in the Middle East and cannot exist for various reasons, some of them because of the military culture, the political culture, etc. Issues such as verification of authority, separation of authority over the delivery systems and the weapons, all of those things which made it more difficult suddenly to rush into nuclear confrontation. Things like permissive action links, which prevented unintentional use. So all put together, we are talking about a very volatile region. We're talking about a possibility that not because Khamenei gets up in the morning and says, oh, what a lovely day, isn't it a great day to drop a bomb, but that because the Iranians do a nuclear alert, the Saudis don't know whether it's directed against them, Israel sees Saudi Arabia and Iran and Turkey on nuclear alert, everybody goes on DEFCON, and things get out of hand because none of these countries have the capability to control this spiral of escalation. Now we're talking about something which is, even if we say it's low probability, but low probability, high consequence. And this is where we stand on that. In other words, we can say, oh, there's a 10% possibility that this will result in nuclear confrontation. Well, 10% probability of total destruction is something that you have to think about. So putting all of that together, I think that I would agree with McNamara that rational actors or rational leaders do not guarantee complete rational processes. And as a final note, we also have to address the issue of the taboo of nuclear weapons. Religious experts in Iran and in the Sunni world all ask themselves, what is a nuclear bomb? Since there can be nothing which the Prophet Muhammad didn't speak about, they have decided that a nuclear bomb is like a catapult. It's just a big catapult. Because a catapult used to be thrown over the walls of a city and you didn't see who it killed, so it's indiscriminate killing. Well, that's like a nuclear weapon. I think that somebody who sees a nuclear weapon like a catapult...
Shmuel Bar, I'm sorry your time is up. Thank you very much. And that concludes round one of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. And now we go on to round two, where the debaters address each other directly and answer questions from you in the audience and from me. We have two teams of two, James Dobbins and Reuven Pedatzur, who are arguing for the motion that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. Their argument is that much as... the U.S. learned to live with a nuclear China. Israel can do the same, that it's not desirable. They're not saying that. But they're also saying it doesn't mean that the sky is necessarily falling. They portray Iran's leaders as not crazy, as is sometimes claimed. They're saying that the Iranians will not win a nuclear war any more than the Israelis. And by the way, they say that attacking Iran to destroy its nuclear program would only strengthen Iran's influence and make it harder to contain than ever. Jeffrey Goldberg and Shmuel Bar arguing against the motion, saying the risks to Israel are unacceptable. They have not, in their statements, promoted an attack on Iran, which they point out is not the premise of the debate, but they are depicting drastic consequences for Israel if a state that hates it as much as the Iranians say they hate Israel would get its hands on a nuclear weapon. They say it would be a defeat for the good guys. It could set off an arms race in the region. Nukes could reach terrorist hands. And bottom line, two or three bombs alone could destroy all of Israel. It's not the Cold War folks in that sense. So those are essentially the arguments that the two sides are making. And I just want to start off the questions by getting to this notion of the moderating influence of having a nuclear weapon that Reuven Pedatzur talked about. He talked about the fact that when China and when Mao got the bomb in 1964, that he became a lot less quote-unquote crazy in that sense that he was depicted and thought of in the West, that he became a lot more sober-minded as a geopolitical thinker and strategist, presumably because of the stakes. And I just want to put that to the other side and take it to Jeffrey Goldberg first. The notion that, in you addressed it a little bit in your response, but I would just like a little bit more detail in recognizing what his argument actually is, that things did change in China at that time. So take on that question, Jeffrey Goldberg.
Well, I would say that there's only a limited amount of knowledge we can gain by analogizing the Chinese Communist Party of 1965 with the mullahs who rule the theocratic authoritarian state of Iran in 2013. I don't want to stretch this to the breaking point, and I feel like that does stretch it to the breaking point. Yes, it's possible. It's possible that Iran will become suddenly a responsible party, but it is revolutionary in nature. I think by the time China reached nuclear status, it was growing into something else. Iran's specific goal is to export the Islamic Revolution throughout the Muslim world. Its specific goal is to destroy Israel. Its specific goal is to liberate Bahrain. A country that has all of these goals, which gains a nuclear weapon, is not going to suddenly say, all right, now that we have the weapon that will finally allow us to do all of the things that we've been telling you we want to do, we're not going to do it.
Okay, Reuven Pedatzur, Jeffrey Goldberg saying that Iran is not China of 1964 in significant ways.
Iran is not China, I agree.
So we can go
absolutely
home.
Absolutely, but China is not alone. Let's talk about India, Pakistan. Let's see that South Korea lives under the shadow of North Korea nuclear umbrella. So it happens to every leadership that acquired...
And what do you think happens to them? And I want to take your answer back to
Jeffrey.
Because
they know what is the price of using the weapons. There is no winning in nuclear war. So in this case, they know exactly what will happen, and that makes
okay.
them...
So
let me give you an example. We're talking about the Iranians, that they are irrational. Let's talk about Khomeini. He was very extremist, right? In 1980, when the war with Iran erupted, he said that he'll never sign a ceasefire agreement with Iraq until they surrendered. In 1988, they started launching missiles, conventional missiles in Tehran, thousands of people dead, and he signed an agreement because the price was too high. And we are talking about conventional missiles, not nuclear missiles.
Okay, so Jeffrey, Reuven gave you the logic behind his analogy of China, that the gravity of the damage, the destruction that the weapons can do will change any leader's thinking.
Well, first of all, let me come back to Pakistan, because I've done a lot of reporting on Pakistan. Pakistan is moving away from minimal deterrence. We know that Pakistan now is mating its weapons and putting them on mobile launchers. So I would caution not to use Pakistan as a great model for
right,
where
take
we're going.
Kargil crisis,
I'm just
for
saying,
example.
But let me just also say this. I think we're actually also talking about the wrong thing. The thing that I worry about more than...
Are you doing a subject change
what?
To avoid the question?
I am not avoiding the question.
Okay.
What?
All right.
No,
well,
no, but I am not avoiding
the question.
I'm going directly
a lot of
at the question by changing the question. I don't...
I just think he gave you the logic
Sure.
And it's got some power
sure.
to it.
Sure, but let me answer the question by saying I don't necessarily think that Ayatollah Khamenei is going to one day wake up and decide to launch a preemptive nuclear strike on Israel because he wants to destroy Israel. What I'm much more concerned about is accidental escalation leading to an all-out nuclear war. Think of it this way. What happened 2 months ago? Hamas fires rockets into Israel. Israel fires back. Hamas escalates. Israel then escalates. Imagine if Iran was in the picture with a nuclear weapon right now. No, just imagine this. Imagine that Iran, in response to Israel's escalation, decides to move warheads closer to their missile launching sites. And the American satellites see this. You'll be living in a Middle East of launch on warning. You'd be living in a situation in which the Israeli prime minister is going to say, the Iranians are moving their missiles to strike us in defense of Hamas. What do I do? We know that the prime minister already wants to do this.
Let Jim Dobbins respond to that.
Well, I don't think the Israeli counterstrike is vulnerable. I mean, the Israelis have nuclear weapons that can't be located, can't be destroyed.
Jim, could you come just a touch closer to your mic?
And so I think that that launch on warning is not a necessary strategy for the Israelis.
Till Tel Aviv is bombed and then launch against Iran?
I think they would. It would obviously depend on the circumstances. If they thought
there's only three cities
if they
in
thought
Israel
they
the
could
size of Staten Island. I mean,
Jeffrey,
it's going to be
on,
yeah.
Hang on, let him answer.
I mean, you know, the United States was just as vulnerable as Israel. We had 24,000 nuclear weapons locked in on us. They would have damaged us just as badly as half a dozen on Israel. The result would have been the same, and it probably would have been worse for the rest of the world. Indeed, it would have been catastrophic for the world as a whole. And we lived with that for 40 years. And all of these problems of launch on warning. Now, I quite take the fact that these regimes don't have the control mechanisms, the command and control, or even the technologies that will make this a safer world. And so I fully acknowledge that there's an element of risk there. I fully acknowledge that Israel shouldn't live with a nuclear Iran if there's a better option. I'm just arguing that there may not be a better option.
Yeah, well, first of all, regarding rationalism and Khomeini, 2 years after the Iraqi invasion of Iran, he could have signed an agreement, he could have stopped the war, but he continued with the war. And the reason that he finally agreed to a ceasefire was because the Revolutionary Guards actually imposed it on him. The other thing is that Iran isn't, unlike China, which was going through a process when it acquired nuclear weapons, China was already moderating its revolutionary zeal. Iran is going through what we would call the second generation of the revolution. I mean, we're already in the sort of Robespierre-style second generation of the Iranian revolution, going back to the pure concept of the revolution. But that really isn't the real issue here. The real issue here, I think, is that analogies are absolutely irrelevant. You never walk into the same stream in the same place twice, and certainly when one stream is in China and the other is in the Middle East. Secondly, the dynamics of multilateral nuclear states is completely different to the dynamics of two main
Let
powers.
Me remind you, it was not bilateral.
It was bilateral.
China was there from 64.
China never had the strategic capabilities of the Soviet Union, and the Chinese didn't have the missile capabilities at the time, and most of the Cold War was clearly a Warsaw Pact against NATO. It was clearly bilateral. So the fact that nominally you also had Britain and France, etc., and you had China, that did not make it multilateral. So it doesn't matter, though, because we're not talking, as a historian, I find it difficult to discuss analogies because we think that historians tend to think that God is in the details. And the details of the Middle East are that we will have a polynuclear Middle East where we will have a Sunni world which is going to see a Shiite nuclear power as an existential threat to the Sunni world. Anybody who's read the bestseller in Saudi Arabia of the Protocols of the Elders of Qom, which tells how the Elders of Qom want to destroy Mecca and Medina, realize that they see this as existential as well. And so we have to understand that this is the situation, and this situation does not augur well for stability.
All right, let me put a different, bring in a different strain of the argument here. To the side that's arguing that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran, your opponents have pointed out that the specific rhetoric of the Iranian regime has discussed a deep aspiration to see Israel gone, wiping Israel off the map. Reuven Pedatzur, why not take that absolutely literally?
By the way, they've never threatened Israel with nuclear weapons. Never. Never. You never find one.
Very quickly. Do you concede that point, that they have never threatened to use nuclear weapons against Israel?
They don't admit that they are developing the weapons.
No.
So how
they
can they
have
threaten?
They have alluded to that, and anybody who reads the materials coming out of media, which is related to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. I'm not even going back to Rafsanjani with his famous statement, but very senior Iranian people connected to Khamenei have made allusions which could clearly be understood.
All right, that's different from Reuven is saying they've never explicitly said, we will get a nuclear weapon and use it to destroy Israel.
If the Ayatollah Khamenei's aide, Rahimian, is saying that he's going to replace Israel with a big Holocaust, I don't think they're putting pumpkins on the catapults. You know, I mean, I don't think you have to stretch
it. So this is their rhetoric. This is their rhetoric for other reasons. They are
right.
not going...
So you're saying that they don't mean it?
They don't...
If
they could do it, they would have done it. But they don't mean that they're going to use the nuclear weapons in order to achieve this goal. No way.
I beg to differ. I think that one of the problems... We as Israelis tend to believe people who say that they want to exterminate us. We have some very, very good historic precedents that people said that somebody said they want to exterminate us and they tried to do it. I don't believe in rhetoric. I think that rhetoric becomes action when it can become action.
Reuven Pedatzur.
So you believe that the minute they'll have their weapons, they'll try to destroy Israel?
No, I didn't say that. I said that given circumstances in which there will be escalation, that no party in this region will be able to prevent, will have dominance.
I don't agree, because what will happen, it's what happened between the two superpowers. Means of communication will develop.
We haven't heard from Jim Dobbins in a minute and a couple of minutes. And Jim, for you also this question. If the Iranians are so explicit about their desire to see Israel gone, whether they use an active verb or a passive verb, should the Israelis not take that literal seriousness? And can you come close to your mic on your answer?
I mean, I think what... A benign explanation, and I'm not arguing that one should necessarily accept a benign explanation, is that the Iranians are simply arguing for a multi-ethnic state encompassing all of historic Israel to include the West Bank, which is the Hamas position, for instance. It's not that the Israelis should go away, it's that Israel should go away, and that a multi-ethnic state encompassing both Palestinians and Israelis should continue to exist. Interestingly enough, there are extremists, but viable parties in Israel who also think that the Israeli state should encompass all of the West Bank.
Okay.
The difference is that they think it should be a Jewish state, whereas the Iranians would argue it should be a multi-ethnic state.
Jeffrey Goldberg.
Just very briefly on that. What happened was Israel's enemies realized that talking about pushing the Jews into the sea was not really a great PR strategy. Right. So what they did was they changed the language and they said, we don't want to push the Jews in the sea. We just want to get rid of Israel as a Jewish homeland and let everybody live there together. But then they also say, as the Ayatollahs say, all the Jews who aren't from there have to go back to where they're from, which leads to these incredible statements, and I heard this from many
Iranian officials
saying the Jews should go back, the Jews from Germany should go back to Germany, the Jews from Poland should go back
to Poland.
But
Jeffrey, I think what Jim's saying is that you could interpret the, and I'm not saying this facetiously, the Iranians are, they're not saying we will kill you, they're saying we want you dead. Which is not exactly the same thing. Which has to do with.
But no, we don't. We want a lot of you dead, and we certainly want your country and your dream of a Jewish homeland dead. So you know, to Israelis and to Jewish people.
But it means would they be the agents of that killing?
Were they able to get away with it? But
I just want to know about Hamas.
I think that Hamas was mentioned.
Wait. I love it when everybody's talking. Yeah, it's so exciting, but we need to have some order. Then you, Reuven.
I know a thing or two about Hamas, and I read their websites avidly. Maybe that's an aberration. And on their main website, they have constantly the hadith from the Prophet saying that the last day will not come until the Muslims kill all the Jews, and the last Jew will hide behind a rock or a stone, and the rock will call out, "Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him." Now, I don't call this a multi-ethnic state.
Have you seen this constantly...
And they have these on their TV. You have children called up to quote it, and they get prizes for quoting things like that.
Have you seen the website of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef?
It doesn't come near that.
Look, we're not arguing, by the way, that the Lubavitcher should get nuclear weapons. I mean, you know, I have a general predisposition against letting nutjob religious fundamentalists, that's the technical
it
term.
It will be nice if they don't
all
have
all stripes get hold of nuclear weapons. It's a pretty simple point.
It's very nice if they don't have their weapons, but if they'll have, then what?
I think we already described what could happen.
I'm going to come to you.
Israel will have our time.
I'm going to come to you in the audience for questions shortly. I just want you to get ready. Folks, if you're upstairs, I won't be able to call on you, but if you want to ask a question, come on down and just stand in the back, and I'll see that you came downstairs, and I'll try to call on you for making the effort. I would really urge you to make these questions really, really brief and to form them as questions, not debating points, as questions. And you'll know it's a question if a question mark goes at the end of what you say. And that it be on this point. We're not debating whether the Israeli government should launch an attack on Iran. We're trying to debate a little bit, as has been put before, as the day after. What would be the consequences for Israel of Iran getting a nuclear weapon? And so as you're getting ready to do that, I just want to go back to the side that's arguing that Israel cannot live with a nuclear weapon and point out that your opponent, Jim Dobbins, made the point that he asked, what actually would the Iranians be able to start doing that they're not already doing in terms of killing Jews around the world and in terms of encouraging attacks from Hamas and Hezbollah and being generally mischievous and deadly? What would be different if they had a nuclear weapon? Jeffrey Goldberg.
They have limitless escalation. Like I said, if Hamas has the protection of the nuclear umbrella, the Iranian nuclear umbrella, it can be much bolder than it is today. Israel will then have to fear.
Doing what? More than 1,000 missiles?
Yeah.
20,000? Yeah. No, they don't
have. Hezbollah has 50,000 missiles sitting in Lebanon, pointed at Israel right now.
Jim Dobbins, it was your point. Let's hear your response to it, please.
But, you know, I mean, quoting from extremist websites is one thing, but as far as I know, the largest Jewish population in the Middle East that doesn't live in Israel lives in Iran.
The largest what?
Jewish population in the Middle East that doesn't live in Israel lives in Iran.
No, I think they're in Israel.
200 people.
The largest Jewish population that doesn't live in Israel lives in the Middle East.
Got it.
If they wanted to start killing Jews, they'd have an easy opportunity.
The Jews in Iran are under what it's called Vimy. They are under protection. That's something else. But
Jim, I just before you get to that,
Jews have fled
Jim,
Iran
I want you to get back.
Revolution.
I want you to defend your opening point that Jeffrey just refuted. Iran having a nuclear weapon wouldn't be doing much more than it's already doing. He says yes, they would because they could escalate under protection.
Nuclear weapons are extremely useful to deter people from using other nuclear weapons or from destroying their regime. There was one option that the United States would lose if Iran had a nuclear weapon, which it's lost with respect to North Korea, and that is to invade and overthrow the regime. That would be off the table. We might do other things to them. We've got 5,000 nuclear weapons. They've got 2 or 3. There's almost nothing we could do to them short of threatening to overthrow the regime, which would cause them to use their nuclear weapons. And I think Israel has never had the capacity of invading and overthrowing the regime. Israel's not going to use its nuclear weapons to respond to rocket attacks from Hamas. It's got other conventional responses to that, which it can fall back on. whether Iran has nuclear weapons or not. And Iran is not going to start a nuclear war to protect Hamas.
I totally disagree that nuclear weapons are only for deterrence. They actually have only been used for deterrence in a very limited case that we know of the Cold War. But nuclear weapons can be used for compellence. And if you imagine Iran having a certain window of opportunity when the rest of the Middle East has not acquired nuclear weapons, and they do have an agenda. The Iranians are making it clear, actually they've escalated their rhetoric about Bahrain being part of Iran, which was stolen by the Brits. They would probably take advantage of it to brandish nuclear weapons as a means of compellence in order to get the level of hegemony in the Gulf and in the Middle East before the rest of the countries do acquire nuclear weapons. So I think that that is the most likely scenario. So it's not only what they could do against Israel, but what they do against Saudi Arabia, Bahrain,
without arguing that it's impossible, I'm not going to argue it's impossible.
So
there's no historic,
historic
example of successful compellence since 1945. There's no case in which a nuclear power used its nuclear power to compel some other country.
Powers.
Britain and France got thrown out of every single colony they had in the world while they were nuclear powers, and their colonial powers weren't.
Analogies of such small sets have absolutely no scientific relevance.
I'm bothered by that because that gives us nothing to talk about from history.
Right. I mean, history is.
I mean,
we've got to
look back to some degree. I mean, it's your response every time. Every time they bring up something from history, you say it's irrelevant.
No. From history, you can bring up things from history, but you have to bring up things from relevant history in a relevant region, in relevant circumstances and culture.
So what is relevant,
Shmuel? The United States and the Soviet Union, France and Britain.
Shmuel, what is relevant?
Has nothing to do with what happens in a region where people.
I think we're having an Israeli moment here. Shmuel, what is relevant?
Jeffrey said that Israel will have hard time. We always have hard time.
Nothing
will change.
Yeah, you always have a hard time. Some of it's self-inflicted. Some of it is inflicted from outside. The proportion of the stuff that's going to be inflicted from outside is going to grow much greater. You know, and Jim Dobbins is right. I mean, he's right. The day after Iran gets a nuke, you know, chances are Israel will still survive. I mean, it's a remote possibility that Israel could survive 2 or 3 or 4 years. But
so
I really do believe that Iran getting a nuclear weapon. And by the way, it's not the Israelis who believe. It's just the U.S. that believes this.
Well, Jeffrey, you said 2 or 3 years Israel would survive.
I believe that every 3 to 4 years, there's another confrontation between Israel and one of Iran's proxies on its northern border or its southern border.
That is nothing
to
do.
The next time there's one of these conflicts, I'm afraid that they're going to spin out of control. By that point, Saudi Arabia might have nukes, Turkey might have nukes, Egypt might have nukes. I don't see this as President Obama said repeatedly, that is, you know, to introduce so many nuclear weapons into such a small space that is already politically unstable, politically volatile, is a recipe for disaster.
So when Jim Dobbins said this debate isn't literally saying Israel can survive, you actually are taking it literally, that you think Israel cannot survive.
Oh, I read the instruction sheet wrong?
Yeah.
Oh, really? No, I believe that it makes it Israel. Why does Israel survive and thrive now? It survives because it's an immigration nation. Who's going to immigrate to a country that's on a hair trigger nuclear alert, that lives under this Iranian nuclear umbrella?
It survives
because of investment. Who's going to build a $1 billion chip plant in Israel if they think that chip plant is going to be blown up in a nuclear war?
Who immigrated to the United States, Jeffrey, with 25,000 missiles aimed at every target in the States?
Yeah. But it was never the level.
And I hope that we'll survive more than 3 years.
The level of conflict was
never.
You should survive forever, and that's what we're talking about. And I just don't see the Middle East that's polynuclear as a hospitable place for a small Jewish state that already has multiple dysfunctions.
I agree. It's not a nice neighborhood.
There's no autumn. There's no automaticity to the
next debate.
Jim, I just need you near the mic. We can't hear you.
Yeah, there's no automaticity to the idea that Iran's gaining nuclear weapons is going to proliferate. It's a risk, like these other things, and it's a risk that the U.S. takes seriously, which is one of the reasons why it's threatened to bomb Iran. It's not as if there's a gulf between the Israeli leadership and the leadership in Washington. They both agree that they should bomb Iran rather than allow it to have nuclear weapons. They just disagree about when.
Let's hear your questions. Front row, gentlemen, right here. And just rise. And we also need, folks, because of the radio broadcast, also hold the mic about that distance from your mouth. And tell us your name and ask your question.
Sure. My name is Randy Slifka. And Mr. Dobbins, the answer to your question is to mow the grass. That's what can be done. But I just want to follow up on Mr. Goldberg's line of thinking, which is the economic analysis, which is how many thousands of people will actually, human capital, will leave Israel? How much actual capital, billions of dollars? Who is going to actually invest in Israel, given the fact there is no margin for error? And not only do you have explicitly nuclear weapons pointed at you, but you also have the danger of dirty bombs and technology transfer within the country.
That's
within
a great
the city itself.
Question, and it was really well done, let me just say. I mean, that's the model. Go ahead, Jim Dobbins.
The United States had a peer competitor that had, in many cases, more nuclear weapons than we did. People invested. We had huge immigration. People went to New York and Washington, and they knew that they were going to be exterminated if there was a war. They were right in the hair trigger. Whatever, wherever else the bombs fell, they were going to fell there. Did it stop building? Did it stop immigration?
First of all, there's a difference in margin of safety.
Wait.
Why?
That's for these
Why
guys.
Why is there a difference? Well,
they're the debaters.
Why is there a difference?
Jeffrey, you have to say, first of all, there's a margin of safety issue. No, seriously, I just want your question to provoke them. It's a great question, though, Jeffrey.
Am I supposed to deal with just the economic issue?
No, you're to respond to their response.
I'd let Shmuel do that.
All right, Shmuel.
Okay.
If you want to pass, you can.
I don't know if everybody will leave Israel. I'll probably be the one who turns off the lights at Ben-Gurion Airport. But I think it is absolutely ridiculous and absurd to compare a situation in which a country which is has declared that it wants to exterminate the state of Israel has nuclear weapons, as opposed to the balance which existed post-Cuba between the United States and the Soviet Union, even though they both had nuclear weapons. You can make those analogies, but they have absolutely nothing to do with
not
reality. It's not a real analogy. And I think that it would certainly have an effect. By the way, an interesting poll in Israel was taken, and people were asked, will you leave the country if Iran gets a nuclear weapon? It turned out that whereas somewhere around 30% of the Jews said they would think about it, 70% of the Israeli Arabs said they would think about it.
All right. You know what? The part of your question that was really good that you were getting on your follow-up didn't get asked. So go. Mike is back to you. Margin of error question.
Well, first of all,
stand up, please, if you don't mind.
Well, first of all, there's obviously an issue of a dirty bomb or the fact there's no geographic margin of error. But I really think that you've ignored the key issue, which I was trying to address in terms of my question, which is the actual capital which has been invested in Israel. Who is going to actually invest continuously in a country where you have the threat of existential destruction?
All right.
And
do you
in
think-
fact, there was what a follow-up. The Israeli economy has been thriving and has been doing tremendously well. But given the fact that if there is this threat that's going on, the risk of an incremental investment there is just tremendous.
We get it. Thanks. Do you want to take that, Reuven? I mean, it's a good question. Who's going to keep going to Israel investing in Israel?
First of all, Jim gave an absolutely brilliant
by comparing it to the
answer. But who is investing in a country when there are 60,000 missiles aimed at? Who invests in Israel these days?
But I don't think you can compare conventional rockets to nuclear weapons.
Of course not.
You had a lot of subtext there. And so can you draw out what your point was?
I believe
you put it in a rhetorical question that none of us could answer.
I believe that most...
So make your point more explicitly.
I believe that most of the Israelis will stay in Israel, even if there will be a nuclear
rocket. Is your point that Israel is already kind of a nasty neighborhood and there are already Hamas
and
rockets landing and people are already investing
in it? I don't like our neighbors. But
let's go to another question. Ma'am, right there. If you can tell us your name as well, please.
Hi, Kantha Ahmed. I'm a Muslim author. To my colleagues, Mr. Barr and Mr. Goldberg, I would say what's different and what you're arguing clearly is that the new ingredient is virulent political Islamism, which both of you have touched upon, which changes the equation, not just the polynuclear conflict. I think that's what makes this so much more dangerous than anything history has previously seen in terms of the Cold War. Would you agree, and could you expand?
Wait, are you asking them if... You're saying you agree with them?
I agree.
But then you're asking them if they agree with you.
And also...
I agree.
But do you not want to put that question to this side?
As you're the moderator, but I think that's the part that's overlooked entirely.
So turn that into a question for this side, because I think that's what your intention really is.
Why do you not feel that the ingredient of political Islamism, which is actually decimating so many Muslim states politically and ideologically and contributes to the destabilization in Pakistan, the country of my heritage, is not a destructive factor that is alien from the previous 60 years of nuclear armaments?
Well,
Jim Dobbins.
First of all, Iran has been a virulently Islamist state for 30 years now, 40 years? 79. It's probably a little less virulent now than it was, but it's still a virulent Islamist state. And yet it hasn't behaved irresponsibly in the sense of doing anything that endangers its existence. The regime has done lots of outrageous things, but none of them threatened its existence. None of them threatened the continuity of the regime. Iran, in fact, hasn't invaded anybody for 500 years, so it's not as if they have territorial claims. They're promoting subversion. They're promoting overthrow of hostile regimes. They're engaging in terrorism, and I would anticipate that they would continue to do so. At no point has either American or Israeli nuclear weapons deterred them from that. I don't think there's any level of that that they could engage in that would result in a nuclear strike on our part. And therefore, I don't think that their having nuclear weapons would particularly affect that kind of behavior, which we would continue to have to respond to forcefully and at times, and certainly rigorously. But I don't think it would be notably harder.
Jeffrey
and Goldberg. As far as Islam in the Arab world, or for that matter in the South Asian world, I don't know that it's particularly, you know, relevant to this problem. It's certainly a challenge.
Well,
to answer the question, one of the saving graces of the Cold War was that the Soviets were atheists, and that they didn't envision this world as simply the anteroom to a superior afterlife. And so I do think you have to take into account, not just with Islam, but with, as I said before, fundamentalist Jewish parties in Israel, I wouldn't want to see controlling nuclear weapons. We're entering the age of political Islamism in the Middle East. The Muslim Brotherhood is in charge of Egypt today. In another year, it's going to be in charge of Syria. I'll answer this question with a question to the audience, in a way, which is, would you be comfortable having the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt be in control of nuclear weapons? Would you be comfortable having the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria be in charge of nuclear weapons? And for that matter, would you be happy if the chief rabbis of Israel had nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
I don't know. The chief rabbis of Israel do not have nuclear weapons. It is very clear to everyone, including President Obama, the day after there's going to be the day after Iran goes nuclear, there's going to be a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. President Obama has warned about this. He said very explicitly that a nuclear arms race in the world's most volatile region is inherently destabilizing. So you're dealing with, in a few years' time, the possibility that four or five different countries that all hate each other are going to be pointing nuclear-tipped missiles at each other. That's not a recipe for stability or happiness. It's certainly not a recipe for stability for the Jewish state. Second reason. If you believe that Israel can only survive if it makes peace with its neighbors, then you will be opposed to the idea of Iran getting a nuclear bomb. Israel cannot survive in a Middle East in which America is a defeated and weakened ally. America is Israel's most important ally. If Iran trumps America, if Iran beats America by getting a nuclear weapon, it means that the Arab states that would predisposed to make peace with Israel, and we know the peace process is semi-moribund anyway, they will align with Iran because Iran is the winner of that conflict. The third and most obvious point is Hamas and Hezbollah even now periodically fire large numbers of rockets at Israeli civilians. Imagine the power that they will have when they can fire those rockets under the protection of the Iranian nuclear umbrella. Again, there is a real chance that an Iranian nuclear weapon would lead to a conflagration in the Middle East. Even without that conflagration, it becomes very, very hard to envision how Israel survives in the long term. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeffrey Goldberg. And a reminder of what's going on, we are halfway through the opening round of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan. We have four debaters, two against two, who are arguing it out over this motion, Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. You've heard two of the opening statements, and now on to the third. Debating in support of the argument, James Dobbins. He is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State and Special Envoy under the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. He is now Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Ladies and gentlemen, James Dobbins.
Well, just to remind us what we're debating about, the proposition is, can Israel live with a nuclear Iran? Can Israel survive a nuclear Iran? The answer to that question is yes. You don't need to be absolutely certain it will survive. In fact, technically, you don't even think it has to be probable that it will survive, just that it's possible that it will survive. And I think both of the opposition will acknowledge that it's possible it will survive. Indeed, Jeff said that they'd have a hard time, which implicitly indicates that there's a good possibility they'd survive. It'd just be harder. I think if you debate at that level, it's pretty clear. There's almost nobody who thinks that Israel's demise will be automatic and certain. It's the question of risk. And so I think, in a sense, the real debate is, should Israel live with a nuclear Iran? And the answer is, not if they can help it. Obviously, nobody thinks a nuclear Iran is a good idea, and we're already doing a lot to try to prevent it. We have a massive, probably unprecedented international sanctions regime, an active, if so far unproductive, diplomatic process, a very active and somewhat successful covert sabotage effort, and cyber attacks. Now, these may work in some combination, but I'd have to acknowledge that they may not. And so the remaining question is, should one, if these fail, go to war to prevent Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon? And I think, although that's not precisely what we're debating, it does tend to be, the issue does tend to revolve around that. Now, the threshold for saying yes, that we should go to war to prevent Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon, really has to go, there are two thresholds. One is efficacy, and one is unintended consequences. You need to look at both. In terms of efficacy, I think most experts believe that an Israeli attack on Iran would set the program back by perhaps 2 years, that an American attack would be more effective and would set it back by maybe 4 or 5 years. It wouldn't prevent it, but it would slow it down. What about the unintended consequences? Well, most people are concerned about the possibility of counterattacks. Iran begins rocketing Israeli nuclear facilities, terrorist attacks. But in many ways, the more dangerous response is, first of all, that an unprovoked attack on Iran validates their case for a nuclear weapon, for a nuclear deterrence. North Korea doesn't suffer those kinds of attacks. Pakistan doesn't suffer those kinds of attacks. And many in the world and in Iran will come around to the view that maybe Iran actually needs a nuclear weapon. A second consequence is that you begin to collapse the international coalition that so far has made Iran a pariah state, that has cut off its access to international markets, international, not just nuclear technology, but any kind of military technology, and increasingly even cut back dramatically its oil sales. And as a result, Iran gains access to the world economy. It breaks out of its isolation, and even perhaps certainly gains access to sophisticated military technology. In the aftermath of an attack, wouldn't Russia be prepared to sell Iran the kind of air defense systems which so far it's refused to sell Iran, and perhaps even nuclear technology from states like Pakistan or others, North Korea? I think in evaluating these consequences, one has to go back to the question of what is it that we, and for that matter, most Israelis, fear about Iran? And I think Jeff has pretty much answered that question. It's not Iranian invasion. it's Iranian subversion. It's Iran's capacity to appeal to militant elements within neighboring populations, dissident elements within neighboring populations, in order to galvanize their efforts both against their own regimes in many cases and against Israel. It's Iranian influence, it's Iranian capacity for subversion. It's not that Iran is going to march across two intervening states and invade Israel. That is of concern. And the fear is that they would be emboldened and they'd do more of this. But I think you have to ask yourself, which kind of Iran would have more influence with these dissident populations, not with governments, but with dissident populations in places like Gaza and Lebanon and other Middle East states, an Iran that had nuclear weapons or an Iran that was the victim of an unprovoked attack? Which of those two would give Iran greater influence and capacity to mobilize those kinds of populations? I think the answer to that is fairly clear. Now, the argument that Iran would be emboldened by possessing a nuclear weapon is certainly, I think, a real danger, but it's far from a certainty. It's not the historic pattern. You know, our major problems with the Soviet Union and particularly with China occurred before they had nuclear weapons. You know, Soviet Union gobbled up all of Eastern Europe before it had nuclear weapons. We had nuclear weapons. They didn't. China actually attacked the United States and Korea and waged a two-year war with the United States and Korea. They didn't have nuclear weapons. We did. Once they got nuclear weapons, we didn't have any more wars. Now, we had lots of confrontations, but they were eventually diffused. Both North Korea and Pakistan do behave irresponsibly on occasion, but there is a certain stability in their relations with India, Pakistan's relations with India, North Korea's relations with South Korea. There haven't been conflicts in either case. So the argument that they'd be emboldened to the point of actually threatening to use nuclear weapons or using nuclear weapons or even engaging in the kind of behavior that they're not engaging in now, and I think if you listen to Jeff's list of all the things they're doing, you'd have to ask, well, what the hell else could they do that they're not already doing? And I think the answer is not much.
Thank you, James Dobbins. Our motion is that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. And now our final debater, who will be speaking against the motion, Shmuel Bar. He is the Director of Studies at the Institute of Policy and Strategy in Herzliya. He is also a Senior Research Fellow for the International Institute for Nonproliferation Studies. Shmuel, you can start making your way to the lectern. He served for 30 years in the Israeli government, in the Israeli Defense Forces Intelligence, and in the Office of the Prime Minister. Ladies and gentlemen, Shmuel Bar.
Thank you. First of all, I won't go into the post-attack scenarios that were brought up, but suffice to say that I could offer more optimistic scenarios. When you shuffle a deck of cards, then you play a completely new game. I recall that when we took out the Iraqi reactor, we thought it would delay it for 3 years, but it took about 10 years, and the Iraqis did not get back to the level that they were before we took out the Ozirak. Now, the arguments that are brought up, the rational actor model, which I've already made some remark as a historian about, and the idea that deterrence works, and the other, the Cold War paradigm can be applied. I would argue that we have to look at both of these assumptions in a completely different manner. First of all, the rational actor model. Somebody, not me, McNamara, said that Castro was a rational man, Khrushchev was a rational man, Kennedy was a rational man, and three rational men almost brought their nations into utter destruction. And that was without any, Che Guevara said that it would be that if Cuba had to be destroyed in order to destroy the destroy capitalism, then Cuba would be thankful for that. But in other words, rational people sometimes do things, or the dynamics between rational people, rational leaders, sometimes leads to things which are not rational. The other thing is that strategic surprises have happened. I don't think there's anybody here who would debate the fact that strategic surprises have happened. And when they happen because things that hordes of analysts and pundits and journalists have said are completely impossible because it is irrational that people will act that way, but they happened. So the fact is that these surprises happen, and they reflect dynamics which were not pure game theory rational behavior. Now, the other thing is that if nuclear weapons make countries more responsible, then I would propose that the United States, which wants to reduce its nuclear arsenal, should now just divvy out all of the American nuclear weapons to the whole world, and then everybody will become very responsible, very rational, and peace on earth and goodwill towards men. Now to the Cold War paradigm. The Cold War paradigm, let's define what it was. It was bilateral. It was a paradigm which from a certain stage had mutually assured destruction, with each party having a second strike capability. It was with levels of intelligence that when these both of the United States and Soviet Union acquired that capability, the second strike capability, they also had satellites in the sky, so they had a reasonable picture of what was going on in the silos of the respective enemies. There were mutual communications after Cuba, and there was also a perception of a taboo after Hiroshima. Now, when we're talking about a nuclear Iran, we have to understand we are talking about a polynuclear Middle East. The nuclear Shiite Iran is going to be perceived by the Sunni countries as something that cannot be countenanced, that they are going to have to acquire their own nuclear weapons. In a polynuclear Middle East where every country has a very small arsenal, they do not have mutually assured destruction. They have a sort of arsenal which is use it or lose it. If we are attacked, then we won't have a second chance. We are going to have multiple nuclear states with these small arsenals with very low levels of intelligence. They won't have satellite intelligence or very clear picture of what the real intentions of their enemy are. The size of the arsenals, it's better to have a lot of bombs than a few bombs, because then, of course, you have the propensity to say, well, if I don't use it now, I won't have a second chance. But then I want to go into something which has to do with command and control. And this is a very esoteric area, but in order to prevent unintentional use of nuclear weapons or use of nuclear weapons without total control over the process of what's called escalation dominance, you have to have very sophisticated capabilities. When you look at the command and control structures in the various countries of the Middle East and the paradigms which existed in the Cold War countries, you actually discover that most of the key elements which were instrumental in preventing nuclear confrontation during the Cold War do not exist in the Middle East and cannot exist for various reasons, some of them because of the military culture, the political culture, etc. Issues such as verification of authority, separation of authority over the delivery systems and the weapons, all of those things which made it more difficult suddenly to rush into nuclear confrontation. Things like permissive action links, which prevented unintentional use. So all put together, we are talking about a very volatile region. We're talking about a possibility that not because Khamenei gets up in the morning and says, oh, what a lovely day, isn't it a great day to drop a bomb, but that because the Iranians do a nuclear alert, the Saudis don't know whether it's directed against them, Israel sees Saudi Arabia and Iran and Turkey on nuclear alert, everybody goes on DEFCON, and things get out of hand because none of these countries have the capability to control this spiral of escalation. Now we're talking about something which is, even if we say it's low probability, but low probability, high consequence. And this is where we stand on that. In other words, we can say, oh, there's a 10% possibility that this will result in nuclear confrontation. Well, 10% probability of total destruction is something that you have to think about. So putting all of that together, I think that I would agree with McNamara that rational actors or rational leaders do not guarantee complete rational processes. And as a final note, we also have to address the issue of the taboo of nuclear weapons. Religious experts in Iran and in the Sunni world all ask themselves, what is a nuclear bomb? Since there can be nothing which the Prophet Muhammad didn't speak about, they have decided that a nuclear bomb is like a catapult. It's just a big catapult. Because a catapult used to be thrown over the walls of a city and you didn't see who it killed, so it's indiscriminate killing. Well, that's like a nuclear weapon. I think that somebody who sees a nuclear weapon like a catapult is
somebody
who shouldn't.
I'm sorry, your time is up. Thank you very much. And that concludes round one of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. And now we go on to round two, where the debaters address each other directly and answer questions from you in the audience and from me. We have two teams of two, James Dobbins and Reuven Pedatzur, who are arguing for the motion that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. Their argument is that much as the U.S. learned to live with a nuclear China, Israel can do the same, that it's not desirable. They're not saying that. But they're also saying it doesn't mean that the sky is necessarily falling. They portray Iran's leaders as not crazy, as is sometimes claimed. They're saying that the Iranians will not win a nuclear war any more than the Israelis. And by the way, they say that attacking Iran to destroy its nuclear program would only strengthen Iran's influence and make it harder to contain than ever. Jeffrey Goldberg and Shmuel Bar arguing against the motion, saying the risks to Israel are unacceptable. They have not, in their statements, promoted an attack on Iran, which they point out is not the premise of the debate, but they are depicting drastic consequences for Israel if a state that hates it as much as the Iranians say they hate Israel would get its hands on a nuclear weapon. They say it would be a defeat for the good guys. It could set off an arms race in the region. Nukes could reach terrorists' hands. And bottom line, two or three bombs alone could destroy all of Israel. It's not the Cold War folks in that sense. So those are essentially the arguments that the two sides are making. And I just want to start off the questions by getting to this notion of the moderating influence of having a nuclear weapon that Reuven Pedatzur talked about. He talked about the fact that when China and when Mao got the bomb in 1964, that he became a lot less, quote-unquote, crazy in that sense that he was depicted and thought of in the West, that he became a lot more sober-minded as a geopolitical thinker and strategist, presumably because of the stakes. And I just want to put that to the other side and take it to Jeffrey Goldberg first. The notion that, you addressed it a little bit in your response, but I would just like a little bit more detail in recognizing what his argument actually is, that things did change in China at that time. So take on that question, Jeffrey Goldberg.
Well, I would say that there's only a limited amount of knowledge we can gain by analogizing the Chinese Communist Party of 1965 with the mullahs who rule the theocratic authoritarian state of Iran in 2013. I don't want to stretch this to the breaking point, and I feel like that does stretch it to the breaking point. Yes, it's possible. It's possible that Iran will become suddenly a responsible party, but it is revolutionary in nature. I think by the time China reached nuclear status, it was growing into something else. Iran's specific goal is to export the Islamic Revolution throughout the Muslim world. Its specific goal is to destroy Israel. Its specific goal is to liberate Bahrain. A country that has all of these goals, which gains a nuclear weapon, is not going to suddenly say, all right, now that we have the weapon that will finally allow us to do all of the things that we've been telling you we want to do, we're not going to do it.
Okay, Reuven Pedatzur, Jeffrey Goldberg saying that Iran is not China of 1964 in significant ways.
Iran is not China, I agree.
So we can go
absolutely
home.
But China is not alone. Let's talk about India, Pakistan. Let's see that South Korea lives under the shadow of North Korea nuclear umbrella. So it happens to every leadership that acquired.
And what do you think happens to them? And I want to take your answer back to
because
Jeffrey.
Because they know what is the price of using the weapons. There is no winning in nuclear war. So in this case, they know exactly what will happen, and that makes
okay.
them...
So
let me give you an example. We're talking about the Iranians, that they are irrational. Let's talk about Khomeini. He was very extremist, right? In 1980, when the war with Iran erupted, he said that he'll never sign a ceasefire agreement with Iraq until they surrendered. In 1988, they started launching missiles conventional missiles in Tehran, thousands of people dead, and he signed an agreement because the price was too high. And we are talking about conventional missiles, not nuclear missiles.
Okay, so Jeffrey Reuven gave you the logic behind his analogy of China, that the gravity of the damage, the destruction that the weapons can do will change any leader's thinking.
Well, first of all, let me come back to Pakistan, because I've done a lot of reporting of Pakistan. Pakistan is moving away from minimal deterrence. We know that Pakistan now is mating its weapons and putting them on mobile launchers. So I would caution not to use Pakistan as a great model for
right,
where we're going.
Kargil, Kargil crisis,
I'm just
for
saying,
example.
But let me just also say this. I think we're actually also talking about the wrong thing. The thing that I worry about more than...
Are you doing a subject change
what?
To avoid the question?
I am not avoiding the question.
Okay.
What?
All right.
No, well, no, but I'm not avoiding
the question.
I'm going
been
directly at the question by changing the question. I just
think he gave you the logic.
Sure.
And it's got some power
sure.
to it.
Sure, but let me answer the question by saying I don't necessarily think that Ayatollah Khamenei is going to one day wake up and decide to launch a preemptive nuclear strike on Israel because he wants to destroy Israel. What I'm much more concerned about is accidental escalation leading to an all-out nuclear war. Think of it this way. What happened 2 months ago? Hamas fires rockets into Israel. Israel fires back. Hamas escalates. Israel then escalates. Imagine if Iran was in the picture with a nuclear weapon right now. No, just imagine this. Imagine that Iran, in response to Israel's escalation, decides to move warheads closer to their missile launching sites. And the American satellites see this. You'll be living in a Middle East of launch on warning. You'd be living in a situation in which the Israeli prime minister is going to say, the Iranians are moving their missiles to strike us in defense of Hamas. What do I do? We know that the prime minister already wants to do this.
Let Jim Dobbins respond to that.
Well, I don't think the Israeli counterstrike is vulnerable. I mean, the Israelis have nuclear weapons that can't be located, can't be destroyed.
Jim, could you come just a touch closer to your mic?
And so I think that launch on warning is not a necessary strategy for the Israelis.
Till Tel Aviv is bombed and then launch against Iran?
I think they would. It would obviously depend on the circumstances. If they thought
there's only three cities
in
Israel
thought they
the
could
size of Staten Island. I mean,
Jeffrey,
it's going to be,
on,
yeah.
Hang on, let him answer.
I mean, you know, the United States was just as vulnerable as Israel. We had 24,000 nuclear weapons locked in on us. They would have damaged us just as badly as half a dozen on Israel. The result would have been the same, and it probably would have been worse for the rest of the world. Indeed, it would have been catastrophic for the world as a whole. And we lived with that for 40 years. And all of these problems of launch on warning. Now, I quite take the fact that these regimes don't have the control mechanisms, the command and control, or even the technologies that will make this a safer world. And so I fully acknowledge that there's an element of risk there. I fully acknowledge that Israel shouldn't live with a nuclear Iran if there's a better option. I'm just arguing that there may not be a better option.
Shmuel.
Yeah, well, first of all, regarding rationalism and Khomeini, 2 years after the Iraqi invasion of Iran, he could have signed an agreement, he could have stopped the war, but he continued with the war. And the reason that he finally agreed to a ceasefire was because the Revolutionary Guards actually imposed it on him. The other thing is that Iran isn't, unlike China, which was going through a process when it acquired nuclear weapons, China was already moderating its revolutionary zeal. Iran is going through what we would call the second generation of the revolution. I mean, we're already in the sort of Robespierre-style second generation of the Iranian revolution, going back to the pure concepts of the revolution. But that really isn't the real issue here. The real issue here, I think, is that analogies are absolutely irrelevant. You never walk into the same stream in the same place twice, and certainly when one stream is in China and the other is in the Middle East. Secondly, the dynamics of multilateral nuclear states is completely different to the dynamics of two main
Let
powers.
Let me remind you, it was not bilateral.
It was bilateral.
Trilateral. China was there from 64.
China never had the strategic capabilities of the Soviet Union and the Chinese didn't have the missile capabilities at the time, and most of the Cold War was clearly a Warsaw Pact against the NATO, against NATO. It was clearly bilateral. So the fact that nominally you also had Britain and France, etc., and you had China, that did not make it multilateral. So it doesn't matter, though, because we're not talking, as a historian, I find it difficult to discuss analogies because we think that historians tend to think that God is in the details. And the details of the Middle East are that we will have a polynuclear Middle East where we will have a Sunni world which is going to see a Shiite nuclear power as an existential threat to the Sunni world. Anybody who's read the bestseller in Saudi Arabia of the Protocols of the Elders of Qom, which tells how the Elders of Qom want to destroy Mecca and Medina, realize that they see this as existential as well. And so we have to understand that this is the situation, and this situation does not augur well for stability.
All right, let me put a different, bring in a different strain of the argument here. To the side that's arguing that Israel can live with a nuclear Iran, your opponents have pointed out that the specific rhetoric of the Iranian regime has discussed a deep aspiration to see Israel gone, wiping Israel off the map. Reuven Pedatzur, why not take that absolutely literally?
By the way, they've never threatened Israel with nuclear weapons. Never. Never. You never find...
Do you concede that point,
no,
that they have never threatened to use nuclear weapons against Israel?
They don't admit that they are developing the weapons, so how can they threaten?
They have alluded to that, and anybody who reads the materials coming out of media, which is related to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, I'm not even going back to Rafsanjani with his famous statement, very senior Iranian people connected to Khamenei have made allusions which could clearly be understood.
All right, that's different from Reuven is saying they've never explicitly said we will get a nuclear weapon and use it to destroy Israel.
If the Ayatollah Khamenei's aide, Rahimian, is saying that he's going to replace Israel with a big Holocaust, I don't think they're putting pumpkins on the catapults. You know, I mean, I don't think you have to stretch
so
it.
So this is their rhetoric. This is their rhetoric for other reasons. They are not going.
So you're saying that they don't mean it.
They don't.
If
they could do it, they would have done it. But they don't mean that they're going to use the nuclear weapons in order to achieve this goal. No way.
I beg to differ. I think that one of the problems, and this I must say, we as Israelis tend to believe people who say that they want to exterminate us. We have some very, very good historic precedents that people said that somebody said they want to exterminate us, and they tried to do it. I don't believe in rhetoric. I think that rhetoric becomes action when it can become action.
Reuven Pedatzur.
So you believe that the minute they'll have their weapons, they'll try to destroy Israel?
No, I didn't say that. I said that. Given circumstances in which there will be escalation, that no party in this region will be able to prevent, will have dominance.
I don't agree, because what will happen, it's what happened between the two superpowers. Means of communication will develop.
We haven't heard from Jim Dobbins in a couple of minutes. And Jim, for you also this question. If the Iranians are so explicit about their desire to see Israel gone, whether they use an active verb or a passive verb, should the Israelis not take that literal seriousness? And could you come close to your mic?